Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Of the many images from the Kennedy assassination, perhaps none touched the hearts of a grieving nation more than that photograph. You know the one I'm referring to, the little boy saluting the flag-draped coffin of his dad. Dan Farrell, the man who took that iconic photograph, says it was, quote, the saddest thing I've ever seen in my whole life.
Welcome to episode 2 of Fatal Voyage, John F. Kennedy Jr., Case Solved. I'm your host, ex-homicide detective Colin McLaren. Last time, we heard how JFK Jr. had been born into a dynasty that would become known as Camelot. In this episode, we're going to examine the dark side of that legacy and what has become known as the Kennedy Curse.
So I always have an interest in the Kennedy family and the tragedies that have been, it seems like one thing after another, they just get infected with generation after generation.
So you could call it the Kennedy Curse. You could also call it the Curse of Power. That sometimes people who are in power, these sort of things happen. I think there's something psychological about it. It's almost like the scales have to be balanced. And life says you've been too blessed, you've had too much, and now we're going to take some away from you.
And how that curse would once again exact a terrible toll on the man who, as a little blonde-haired boy, was required to salute the passing coffin of his dead father, as the entire world watched on.
I think there's a parallel or a similarity between the death of the father and the death of the son in that in both cases, there was great unfulfilled potential. We have no idea of what could have happened. So his presidency had great potential. In fact, the potential is so great that most academics rank him as a great president even without having accomplished these things. And the same kind of hovers over the life of John F. Kennedy Jr. The fact that he could have done great things, could have been a president, could have been a governor, a senator, could have been a great public figure the rest of his life and impacted the world for good. So in both cases, they're cut down and cut short of what most people believe would be a great life and a great contribution to humanity.
Following the assassination of President Kennedy, the conspiracy theories began almost immediately. Did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone? Was there a second shooter at the scene? Who was pulling the moving strings behind the scenes, and how deep did the rabbit hole go? Here's JFK historian John Hankey.
There are 10 affidavits in the Warren Commission documents from witnesses in Dealey Plaza who all said that the limousine stopped in front of the grassy knoll. They don't say waiting for the kill shot, but you can put those elements together to see that the Secret Service stopped the limousine in front of the grassy knoll waiting for the kill shot.
In 1964, the Warren Commission, set up by President Lyndon Johnson to investigate the killing, concluded that Oswald was the lone assassin. It was to be another 11 years before another committee ruled that the Warren Commission was fundamentally flawed. And not until 1979 before the House Select Committee concluded that the murder was most likely the result of a bigger, far-reaching conspiracy. However, they did not say who was behind that conspiracy. Like me, JFK Jr. suspected a cover-up. Author Doug Weed has written over 30 books and interviewed no fewer than six presidents and has unrivaled insight into the machinations of the White House.
I received a call from a lady whose father had worked for Frank Church and had been his closest aide. And she told me the story that when it was all over, her father, who had worked so hard for the senator in these hearings, had said, "Why, Senator, didn't you go ahead and publish your findings? Why did you back down after all that you'd gone through?" And she said that Senator Church said to her father, "The country could not have survived if they had known the truth of our investigation into the CIA. It was a lengthy investigation. They interrogated many CIA agents. And at the conclusion of it, it was like he pulled his punches. It was a whimper."
John Jr. was to later begin his own investigation into his father's death.
I felt that it was just something he had to live with, that he was John Kennedy. But he was very proud of it in the sense that he put the number of the PT-109 that was his father's World War II PT boat. He put that on his plane. He thought about his father constantly.
But tragically, the assassination of JFK Sr. was only the beginning. Shortly after midnight, on June the 5th, 1968, Kennedy's beloved uncle, Bobby Kennedy, was also executed. He was killed at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles just hours after winning the California presidential primary. Here's reporter Leon Wagner, who has been close to the Kennedys since the 1970s.
After JFK was assassinated, Jackie really leaned heavily on Bobby, and he spent a tremendous amount of time with her. They spent so much time together, and they were so affectionate that there were rumors that they were having an affair, which I don't know. It is possible. They certainly were tight. But I think more than anything, he was something to lean on. And, you know, because he was her brother-in-law and she trusted him implicitly and he understood her pain, which nobody else really could understand quite the way he could. And then suddenly he was slain. And that was, I guess, in a way, a final blow.
One of the consultants at Bobby's autopsy was forensic pathologist Cyril Wecht.
I was an official consultant to Dr. Thomas Noguchi, Chief Medical Examiner Coroner of Los Angeles County. You'll see my name listed. You look up the autopsy report. In fact, Tom called me about 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, my time. It was 3 hours earlier there from Los Angeles. He didn't need any advice on how to do an autopsy, but he was concerned that they would try to take Bobby Kennedy's body away like they had done with JFK in Dallas. And Tom and I had become good friends at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and he knew of my outspoken comments regarding what they had done. And I advised him, in fact, among things which he did was to invite, act in a proactive fashion, and invite the government to send in their forensic pathologists to be observers at your autopsy. And he did that, and 3 of those military forensic pathologists, whom we knew, they were colleagues, they attended.
Despite the attempt at transparency, it seemed that, once again, a Kennedy assassination was followed by another shady cover-up.
By the way, in the cover-up, remember the scenario in which Bobby Kennedy was assassinated? Look it up. The distance from which the fatal shot was fired, striking him just above and slightly behind the right ear, was 1 to 1.5 inches. 1 to 1.5 inches. And the bullet also had a slightly forward trajectory, sort of in front of him. And you got to ask yourself, how is this possible? I'll tell you how it's possible. because the defense attorney, who, by the way, was not some snot-nosed kid out of law school or in a public defender's office, he was an experienced criminal defense attorney named Grant Cooper, never consulted a forensic pathologist or a ballistics expert, never had anybody testify at the trial, and in the cross-examination of Dr. Noguchi, never asked him the question I asked you 2 minutes ago about the distance from which the shot was fired or his trajectory. Never. So you talk about setups.
True crime, mysteries, trying to get to the heart of stories that have more questions than answers is my passion. I feel compelled. It's like moving the pieces of a puzzle together. With each connection, I see more of the bigger picture. That's why I like to play Best Fiends. Best Fiends is an exciting puzzle that challenges your brain while not being too difficult. Perfect for any kind of downtime, Best Fiends lets you collect adorable characters as the story advances from level to level, and you don't need an internet connection to play. Plus, they're always putting out new themed challenges, so the game is never boring. I find myself playing Best Fiends whenever I have downtime. With over 100 million downloads, I'm clearly not the only one who's obsessed. As more of my family and friends have started playing, we've gotten into some pretty friendly competitions surrounding our progress in the game, and I'm determined to come out on top. I love that it's a fun reason to keep our text chains going while we're social distancing, too. Start playing today. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips. And you can even play online. With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends.
With John and Bobby killed, third brother Ted Kennedy was the last of old Joe's sons still standing. A respected senator himself, he had his own brush with death in 1964 when the plane in which he was travelling crashed in bad weather near Southampton, Massachusetts. The pilot and another passenger were killed, and Ted spent 5 months in hospital recovering from a broken back, punctured lung and broken ribs. Worse was to follow, as reporter Andy Tillett explains.
In 1969, Ted Kennedy was involved in what's now known as the Chappaquiddick incident. He had been at a party in Martha's Vineyard for a group of young women who had worked on Bobby's presidential campaign the year before. He leaves the party with one of the women, a 28-year-old called Mary Jo Kopechne, and while driving across the bridge back from Chappaquiddick Island, loses control and crashes into the water.
Ted Kennedy managed to escape from the car, but Mary Jo did not.
Mary Jo Kopechne died in what seems to have been a tragic accident. But several things didn't add up. Senator Kennedy says he dived below the surface 7 or 8 times to try to rescue her before swimming to the shore and leaving her drowned, still trapped in the car. That may be true, but he then didn't report the accident until the next morning after her body had already been found. Why would he not report it? Did he just go home and go to bed like nothing had happened? He also denied driving under the influence of alcohol, and said that there had been nothing improper about his relationship with Mary Jo. Both statements have been called into question many times in the intervening years.
A week after the crash, Ted Kennedy pleaded guilty to leaving the scene of an accident and was given a 2-month suspended sentence, avoiding imprisonment. Oddly, no autopsy was ever performed on the body of Mary Jo. In 1970, an inquest into Mary Jo's death concluded that several aspects of Ted Kennedy's story of that night were not true. Yet another cover-up, which is now becoming the modus operandi of the Kennedys, hiding the facts.
Mary Jo Kopechne was a cover-up combination. I think just some pressures behind the scenes having nothing to do with politics and with the Kennedys, and that's just a disgrace.
The Kennedy curse was not limited to the sons of Joe Sr., however. Over the coming decades, there were further incidents and deaths, all involving John Jr.'s cousins, 4 of them the sons of Bobby Kennedy.
There did seem to be this extraordinary run of accidents, reckless behaviour, bad luck, call it what you will, with Bobby's kids. I'll just run through a few of them. In August 1973, when he was 20, Bobby's eldest son, Joseph, crashed his Jeep in Nantucket, badly injuring his brother David's back and permanently paralysing David's girlfriend, Pam Kelly. As a result of that, David became addicted to painkillers, which then escalated into heroin. He was later found dead in a hotel room in Palm Beach in 1984 from an overdose of a cocktail of drugs, including cocaine and Demerol. Then you've got another brother, Bobby Jr., also using heroin. He was arrested in 1983 for heroin possession following a near overdose himself. Then finally, there's Michael, who died in 1991 in Aspen, Colorado. He had been playing football on skis without any kind of helmet or other safety equipment when he hit a tree. Just as a kind of postscript, the same year that Michael died, another cousin, William Kennedy Smith, who was the son of John Jr.'s aunt, Jean, was arrested and charged with the rape of a young woman he had met while drinking at a bar in Palm Beach with his uncle, Ted Kennedy. She alleged that after they had returned to the nearby Kennedy estate, he had sexually assaulted her. At trial, however, he was acquitted of all charges. So it seems there's just this kind of litany of recklessness, bad behaviour, criminality and bad luck running through all these kids.
According to Leon Wagner, at least he was never tempted by drugs.
John didn't use drugs. He deliberately didn't because he had a fear of them, because mostly because his cousins, David, Michael, Bobby Jr., all used heroin and, you know, had some terrible experiences with it. David and Michael both died. Michael of a ski accident, but he was inebriated at the time. And Bobby Jr. was arrested in South Dakota and for possession of heroin. And he just didn't like to be around drug use at all.
John Jr. may have stayed away from drugs, but like so many of his family, he had inherited the Kennedy wild streak.
In the 60 years almost since John Kennedy was assassinated, there have been a death in the Kennedy family, an accidental death in the Kennedy family, every 2 years, nearly exactly every 2 years, which is pretty extraordinary, I think, for any family, even a large family like theirs. That sort of sounds like a curse to me, but like I say, it's a curse that they, to some degree, brought upon themselves by risky behavior.
John F. Kennedy Jr. was fearless, and some say he was very reckless, that he took extraordinary chances as a skier, as a kayaker on the water. There's just many occasions where people said, "You're going to kill yourself. What are you doing?"
As a reporter assigned to cover the Kennedys for most of his career, Leon Wagner watched John Jr. grow from a stoic boy into a headstrong young man.
They were wild kids. They were fun to be around, and you never knew quite what to expect from them. I have to say that they had a tremendous exhibitionist streak in them and enjoyed showing off, particularly given the fact that their home, their compound of homes, was a huge tourist attraction. And there was a constant stream of traffic driving 5 miles an hour past the compound, hoping for a look inside. Some of the Kennedy cousins of John Jr.'s had a habit of coming out front and posing and then yanking their blouses up and flashing the tourists. And as one of them told me, that'll give them something to talk about when they get home. When he was in Hyannisport, he would do things like he would take his cousins, and this is part of his exhibitionist thing too. He would organize a party at the Hyannisport Yacht Club, which is just across the street from the compound on the ocean. And they, of course, it's a private club and it's locked up at night, but of course, the Kennedys had keys to it so they could get in anytime they wanted. And they would go take six packs of beer and drink, and they would take off their clothes and skinny dip in the ocean off the dock. Just, you know, at midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, they kind of did whatever they wanted. They ran the place, and the cops, more or less, that surrounded the compound, they had temporary cops They were just hired for the summer and were really hired for the purpose of guarding the Kennedy compound. And I made friends with a couple of them, and they told me some stories that make your hair stand on end about some of their antics. Like, for example, one of the Kennedy women, Jean Kennedy, would tie ropes onto the back of her car and drive around with the kids on their bikes hanging onto the back of it. And she wouldn't go slow. She'd go 15, 20 miles an hour. I mean, it'd been a fatality if something had, God forbid, happened.
Leon believes that the so-called Kennedy curse has its roots in this seemingly ingrained taste for danger rather than extraordinary bad luck.
It occurred to me, with that kind of behavior, and that kind of behavior being encouraged by the grown-ups, who didn't act very grown-up most of the time, that the Kennedy curse was a curse that was brought on by their behavior. It was to some degree that they just couldn't contain themselves. They took risks and did things that ordinary people wouldn't do. And as a result, along the line, although they got away with quite a bit of it, they got away with a tremendous amount of it, that when you consider the outcome, it's not surprising. I mean, if you do that kind of thing all the time, and as they got older, they skied and played football at the same time in Aspen, which is what killed Michael Kennedy, one of John's cousins. And they flew airplanes and they did all the riskiest sports you could possibly do. They just really challenged the harsh reality of life to take them.
There is another trait unique to the Kennedys, that is the family's mafia-like omerta, their code of silence, about anything that might possibly disparage one of their own. Writer and presidential expert Doug Weed explains one tactic used by the family to perpetuate the Kennedy myth.
The Kennedys try to control it, and for many years, when a book would come out that would tell the full story, the Kennedys would have another book ready. They would have someone always writing a book, a friend. And then when the controversial book would come, they'd quickly rush to print their new book so that someone going into a bookstore would be confused and wouldn't know which was the book that they had heard about they wanted to buy. Also, sometimes their official books backfired. They were forced by law to release some of the presidential papers. You can only keep them under wraps for so long, and then by law they have to be public. So when the expiration date came, the Kennedys released tens of thousands and thousands of pages of documents, and they did that to dilute the release so that journalists wouldn't be able to find the more damaging information that was being made public. They went to Robert Dallek, a great presidential historian, and gave him the initial look and the head start to write a good book about John F. Kennedy, which he did. But now it had all this information about how ill Kennedy was, and it had things like his IQ. You can go online and you'll see all kinds of stories about IQs of the American, who was the smartest president, and they'll show pictures of John Kennedy with an IQ of 163, and it's all false. His IQ was 119. He took a written test as a young person at Choate Academy, and those numbers had to be released. He was very poor at math and very poor at science, extremely poor. He was very high in English and in literature. So he sounded very well educated and very impressive. And a 119 is above average IQ. That's a B student in college. So, but it's not 160. That's not accurate. Nevertheless, the Kennedys as a family will promote that.
The effect, as Cyril Wecht explains, is to suppress the truth, blur the facts, and feed the conspiracies.
I don't understand what the problem is, why the Kennedys, as they say, unknowingly, unwittingly, in their uptight feelings, play into the hands of anybody who was involved in these deaths, like the assassinations of John and Robert, and in the accident of Mary Jo Kopechne with Ted Kennedy. Why the Kennedys do this, I don't know. I can't answer that. In that regard, somewhat related, I remember last year when Mrs. Kopechne, the mother of Mary Jo Kopechne, was interviewed, and I remember that, and it brought tears to my eyes. She said the worst mistake she had ever made in her life was vehemently arguing against the exhumation of her daughter and the performance of an autopsy. That is what she said last year.
As the son of JFK, John Jr. effectively found himself at the head of the next generation of this complicated and cursed Kennedy dynasty. Occasionally, the pressure would tell on the young patriarch in peculiar ways. Leon Wagner remembers witnessing one such incident himself.
He was a boy that, I have to say, he had a manic energy to him. And it was impossible for him to sit still for much of a time. And I went to his grandfather, Hugh Auchincloss, his step-grandfather, actually, his funeral in Newport, Rhode Island. And John was, I want to say, about 9, approximately 10, maybe. We were in a very small airport in Newport. They had no Secret Service or any protection. And John was bored with having to wait for their private plane to arrive. And all of a sudden, he just spontaneously sprung out of his seat and started dancing. And I mean, dancing manically, like he couldn't control what he was doing almost. And Jackie, interestingly, just ignored him and let him get it out of the system, I guess. But I was with a photographer, and he, of course, was snapping some pictures. And Jackie walked up to me and said, "Would you please tell him to stop doing that, taking those pictures?" And so I said, "Sure." So, you know, I did. And we let him be. But then he danced like that for, I would say, 10, 15 minutes. And it was quite a display. And I have to think that part of it was his manic energy. Part of it was the fact that he'd been through a lot. And the idea of attending yet another funeral, and his life was just kind of filled with death at that young age. I have to think that that sort of set him off, and that Jackie understood that, and that's why she made no attempt really to stop him or to say anything to him. She just let him get it out of his system. Now, he clearly calmed down. I mean, I never saw him do anything like that, you know, when he got a little older.
As John Jr. grew from child to man, the pressure of living up to the Kennedy name and perhaps the growing dread of the Kennedy curse would only grow with him.
There may be a reason for it, that it may be that, I mean, from the time they're little kids growing up, people come up to him and say, "When are you going to be president?" And especially with John F. Kennedy Jr., because not only was his father president, but his father was assassinated. So it's almost like, "Hey, pal, when are you going to get this back?" It's almost, the pressure is on. So under normal circumstances, the pressure is on these namesakes. They tend to do things that are self-destructive. They become alcoholics. So that's something that happens naturally. But if your dad is assassinated, it's kind of like, "Hey, are you going to let him get away with that? You're supposed to take it back." That's tremendous pressure to be under, to live under. I don't think they would be that overt in their pressure, but it was kind of it was a given. It was pretty hard to avoid. I mean, every time you turned around, anybody you were introduced to or you ever met, it would be discussed. It was something that was faced every day.
he didn't show that there were any, you know, that it affected him in any way, because it would be not mannish, not Kennedy enough to show any emotions about it. But the effect of the assassinations overall on John over the years was to accept his mother's dire warnings that they were out to kill Kennedys. And you would think that that would petrify a young man.
Finally, on July the 16th, 1999, the curse struck again.
So I was in an automobile and the radio was on, and it came over the news that John F. Kennedy Jr., his airplane had disappeared over the Atlantic. And I had chills go down my spine. I thought, this is just, wow. I heard it and I thought, this has happened over and over and over throughout history. This cannot be a coincidence. There must be some terrible pressure. I don't believe in curses, but there must be at some subconscious level something very strong that's going on, that some terrible pressure that's going on. I've had people say that it could be the reverse. I tend to say that they have these feelings of self-destruction, that I'm not going to be president, I'm not going to make it, this is just too much, I can't take this, and that at some unconscious level that's going on. But I've had others say the opposite. They'd say that they felt John F. Kennedy Jr. was just bold beyond reason, that he took great risks, extreme risks, that he didn't wear a life preserver and he'd be out in a kayak, and that he felt he was indestructible, that I'm a Kennedy and nothing can happen to me, I have a destiny. And so I've heard it both ways. I tend to suspect it's the former.
Next time on Fatal Voyage, John F. Kennedy Jr., case solved.
The cocaine just spiraled out of control. That's when he became angry at her and yelled at her and cursed at her.
I said, if I had millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars, the last thing I'd want to be doing is flying there in a small plane.
John F. Kennedy Jr. may have had a death wish when he took that plane up.
The Death of JFK Jr. is hosted by myself, Colin McLaren. It's executive produced by Dylan Howard and Matt Sprouse, and is a production of Broad and Water Studios and Endeavour Audio. Executive producers also include Tom Freestone, James Robertson and Andy Tillett, and the series is written by Dominic Utton. Reporting by Douglas Montero, the series is mixed and engineered by Sean Kravitt and Sam Adder. There is so much more to this story, and you don't want to miss anything, I can assure you. Make sure you subscribe to Fatal Voyage, The Death of JFK Jr., wherever you get your podcasts.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Allow your imagination to be piqued by stories that are brought to life through captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. As an Audible member, you'll be able to keep your heart rate up month after month, because you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. If you're in the mood for a shocking psychological thriller, check out None of This Is True by Lisa Jewell. Embrace brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.